He was afraid that if Britain joined the common market, then in effect there would be a Trojan horse for the Americans.
That was Peter Mangold discussing Charles de Gaulle's opposition to Britain joining the European Economic Community.
Archaeological study of the last 20 years has discovered that the places where medieval religious houses were put in the 7th, 8th, 11th, 12th century coincide with places where votive metalwork was being put into the river Witham from the Bronze Age.
And that was Richard Morris on his new book, Time's Anvil. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast with me, Rob Attar. This podcast is brought to you by the team behind BBC History Magazine, which is the UK's best-selling history magazine. You can find it in all good newsagents and on subscription. We also have digital editions available for the iPad, the Kindle Fire, and Google Play. And at the moment, our Google Play and Kindle Fire editions are only available in the UK, but we hope to roll them out to other countries soon. Look out for details of all of this on our website, historyextra.com. Last week, Prime Minister David Cameron offered the British people a referendum on EU membership, should he still be in power after the next general election. But 50 years ago this month, the talk was all about Britain joining rather than leaving Europe. Prime Minister Harold Macmillan had applied to become part of what was then the European Economic Community, only to be rebuffed by French President Charles de Gaulle. To get the lowdown on this fascinating moment of European disharmony, I spoke to Peter Mangold, a historian and expert on Anglo-French relations. What kind of an organisation was the EEC in 1963 when Britain attempted to join?
It was quite a small organisation, six member states, France, Germany, Italy, and then the three Benelux states, Luxembourg, Belgium and Holland. It was still to some extent getting onto its feet. It had been established with a kind of deal between France, whose primary interest was the support of its very large agricultural sector, and Germany, whose interest was in industrial policy. And the agricultural issue is of considerable importance because Britain didn't really fit in to the common agricultural policy as it was developed and specifically developed to support the French.
Why did Britain not attempt to join when it first began?
For several reasons. Essentially, it's the long-term attitude of Britain towards the continent of Europe. We don't want to get too closely involved. There was a fundamental miscalculation. It was assumed, particularly when the coal and steel community was set up in 1950, the negotiations began in 1950, and then again when the first EEC negotiations began in 1955, it was assumed that this wouldn't get off the ground, and therefore Britain could quite happily ignore it. But essentially, Britain didn't join because Britain was an island, because it was a great power, because its interests were all overseas in the empire, which still existed largely existed in 1957.
What had changed then by 1963 that made Britain want to request to join?
It was becoming clear that not only was the EEC there to stay, but as well as being a common market in economic terms, it also looked as though it was likely to become a political unit which might rival Britain's position with Washington. De Gaulle was the one who was championing the idea of political cooperation, and the British government got concerned that it was going to lose out.
Charles de Gaulle famously said no to Britain's request to join, and I'm sure there were a myriad of reasons, but fundamentally, why did he take that decision?
Fundamentally for two reasons. In the first place, de Gaulle saw the common market and the political organisations which might be developed for it as a power base, and he didn't want Britain as a rival. Britain was an obvious rival. The only possible rival was West Germany. But the West Germany of the early 60s was a very tentative power. It was still very much under the shadow of the war and had no intention of throwing its weight around. Britain might do so. Macmillan specifically talked about leadership of Europe. He never said what he wanted to do with it, but he was interested in leadership. The other reason is that de Gaulle had an obsession both with independence and with anti-Americanism. And I think both of those go back to the Second World War. France had collapsed in 1940. Roosevelt had quickly come to the conclusion that France was finished as a great power. This was anathema to de Gaulle. De Gaulle was determined that France would revive as a great power. But there was also the fact that Roosevelt took very strongly against de Gaulle personally. And he had a very rough time with the Americans, supported by Churchill. And I think he came out of the war highly suspicious of America, both because of what they'd, if you like, done to him during the war, and also because he was a student of realpolitik and was under no illusion of the fact that great powers threw their weight around. And he was afraid that if Britain joined the common market, then, in effect, they would be a Trojan horse for the Americans.
So he wanted to avoid too much American influence over the European group.
Yes. Oh, don't forget also that de Gaulle had withdrawn NATO, withdrawn France from the integrated NATO command, I think very shortly after he came to power in 1958, and the French only returned to that integrated command relatively recently under President Sarkozy.
Was de Gaulle right that America were attempting to extend their influence through British membership of the EEC?
I think he exaggerated it. The Americans certainly strongly supported the British membership bid, and they looked to Britain as, I suppose, a voice in Europe, as somebody who would, a partner who would be likely to sympathize with their views. But his attitude to the Americans, I think, was obsessive, overly suspicious.
De Gaulle and Macmillan had known each other during the Second World War. Was there any level of personal animosity that might have influenced de Gaulle here?
No. On the contrary, they got to know each other in Algeria in 1943 after the Allied landings in North Africa. Macmillan was sent to Algeria basically to gain influence over the Americans. De Gaulle set up his base in Algeria after leaving London. I mean, Algeria was French soil. And they'd formed a kind of friendship. It was very much a political friendship. And Macmillan rather hoped to capitalize on that friendship. He misjudged de Gaulle in this. De Gaulle was not a man who allowed sentiment to get in the way of politics and certainly wasn't going to give way on French interests in recognition of some kind of debt, either to Macmillan personally or to Britain for its role in the war. Macmillan went into the negotiations without a strategy for countering de Gaulle's opposition. His one potential card was the fact that the French nuclear deterrent was at a very early stage and they needed technical help. Macmillan explored the idea of providing this as a quid pro quo for EEC membership. But he had a problem. He couldn't share any of British nuclear technology which had come from the Americans. This was part of the agreement which the British and the Americans had made, I think it was in 1957, on nuclear sharing. And when you started actually looking at what might be available in terms of purely British nuclear technology, which had no American component, there was actually very little. So although Macmillan would have liked to have made a deal, he couldn't actually do it. And that one quid pro quo, which might have tempted de Gaulle, just wasn't available.
He went in empty-handed in the end.
And he made the mistake. He knew that de Gaulle was a ruthless ally. The Foreign Office referred to him as the almost impossible ally. He allowed himself to hope, partly because of the relations he'd established with de Gaulle in the war, that de Gaulle wouldn't be ruthless towards him. And, of course, he was.
France was then only one member of the EEC. Did the other member states back de Gaulle's decision?
They were basically bullied into it. Konrad Adenauer, the West German Chancellor, was unsympathetic towards Britain. He was particularly unsympathetic towards Macmillan because at the time the Russians had been putting a lot of pressure on Berlin and the British had not been very helpful. And Macmillan was also, he'd served in the First World War, he'd been very badly wounded, and he was essentially anti-German. And this meant that Konrad Adenauer, who was the key figure among the other five, was not likely to make a fuss when de Gaulle raised his veto. The other four were strongly opposed. They hadn't been consulted, they hadn't been informed in advance, but there wasn't much they could do.
Because France was then the leading power in the EEC?
It was the leading power in the EEC, and not only the leading power, it was the most skillful power in operating the system.
What impact did this refusal have on Britain and on Harold Macmillan?
It was a very considerable personal blow to Harold Macmillan. The veto is in January 1963. He resigns in October of that year. Some commentators say that he was never quite the same man again after that veto. One shouldn't exaggerate this too much because he'd been in power for 6 years. It's very clear from the time that Britain began negotiating with the six members of the common market in 1961, that Macmillan was getting tired. The Conservative Party was also doing badly in by-elections. So you could say that time was against Macmillan, and this was simply made the inevitable more likely. As far as Britain was concerned, it was a public humiliation. It was a time at which British power was ebbing rapidly. Dean Acheson, a couple of months before the veto, had made his famous remark, which is still quoted, that Britain had lost an empire and failed to find a role. And the 1960s were a particularly bad period for British foreign policy. It was really in something of a limbo. And I think for 10 years, the consequences of not being in Europe were very unfortunate because it was clear that Britain had to join, but at the same time, it couldn't.
When and how did Britain finally gain admission?
There was a second veto. Harold Wilson tried to make an application, and de Gaulle vetoed that, though not as dramatically. And then when Ted Heath came to power in 1971, Heath was the most pro-European of all British prime ministers since the war or subsequently. And he established an understanding with de Gaulle's successor, Georges Pompidou. And once that understanding was made, it became possible to finish off all the complicated technical negotiations in Brussels. So Britain joined in 1973, almost exactly 10 years after the first veto.
And during this period, was the public generally behind Britain's European entry?
One of the criticisms which was made about Harold Macmillan was that he was very slow to come out and make a public call in support of EEC membership. I think I'm going from memory here. The opinion polls are not particularly supportive. And as the negotiations go on, they become a bit less supportive. And de Gaulle is well aware of that. It wasn't a major issue. It certainly wasn't a negotiation in which the Prime Minister knew the whole of the country was behind him.
We're talking about this around the time of the 50th anniversary, but the European Union and Britain's membership of it is still a subject that excites a great deal of debate. Do you think that policymakers of today could learn something from what happened in 1963?
I think there are probably two lessons, though they're indirect. One of them is the importance of France still. I mean, de Gaulle was right in one sense in trying to keep Britain out. He was afraid and knew that once Britain joined, it would be the beginning of a process of enlargement in which other countries would join and French power would be diluted. And that's happened. Having said that, in any renegotiation of Britain's terms, France is going to be crucial. And it certainly would be much preferable to have the French on board than have them not on board. And one gets the impression that the French are perhaps one of the least sympathetic to any renegotiation. I think that the other point is the need to make the case for Europe. If Macmillan had made the case for Europe strongly at the beginning of the negotiations, rather than waiting until sometime late in 1962, it might have been easier to finish the negotiations earlier, or to reach an earlier conclusion. And if that had been done, the goal might have been preempted. So I think a message is, if you're going to be a member of this club, then make sure that everybody understands why it's necessary to be a member, and make that case firmly and loudly in public.
That was Peter Mangold. Peter is the author of The Almost Impossible Ally, Harold Macmillan and Charles de Gaulle, as well as Britain and the Defeated French, From Occupation to Liberation, 1940 to 1944. Both of those books are published by IB Taurus. Before our next interview, I'd like to briefly mention an exciting new app that we've launched for the iPad. The Second World War Story is an interactive guide to the greatest conflict in human history. It's packed with expert analysis, stunning images, and video footage. You can find The Second World War Story at the App Store now. Richard Morris is an archaeologist and former director of the Council for British Archaeology. His latest book, Time's Anvil, England, Archaeology and the Imagination, is an archaeological book, but one with a difference, as it also covers family history, poetry, physics, and other subjects not normally dwelt on by archaeologists. BBC History Magazine's publisher, Dave Musgrove, met up with him in a pub in York, and his first question was to ask Richard what the point of his new book is.
Well, it started out as a book that was about how new technology is influencing what archaeology finds and how new technology can help to tell new stories. And there's a particular technology that keeps recurring in the book. It's called metal detecting. Mm. Now, when I was with the Council for British Archaeology in the 1980s, archaeology and the metal detecting hobby were at loggerheads. The reasons we may have almost forgotten, but they were to do with the fact that archaeological material being found by metal detectors was being dissipated. It wasn't forming any coherent narrative. And there are still archaeologists today. I know plenty of colleagues who are still pretty hostile to the hobby. But we can't escape the fact that metal detectorists have been able to do things that archaeology hitherto had not done. And I'll give you one example. It's in the book, which is that the very, very small silver pennies that are being minted in southern Britain from about the late 7th century through into the 9th century are so small. They're about the size of your fingernail. Or they're beautifully made. And when you actually look at them close up, they're most intricately worked things you'll ever see. They're extraordinary and full of variation, hundreds of different kinds. But we only ever found them because they're so small. And when you find them on excavations, they look like mud anyway, because they don't gleam like silver. They're just sort of little bits of earth. They therefore gave the appearance of being rather rare. And the only time you ever really found them was when you found a hoard in a pot or some other container. And in those cases, you'd find what Mark Blackburn, the late great numismatist from Cambridge, described as a flash of lightning. You know, a coin hoard suddenly sheds light on a moment in archaeology, but not much else. What the detectorists have been finding is individual losses, which give a much better picture of economic activity in the 7th, 8th and 9th century. The coins that fall through your trouser pockets, or the coin that dropped out of your purse while you were making a transaction. And they're finding them by the thousand. So whereas previously we thought they were rare, and that the market economy had almost come to a standstill in the early Middle Ages, there seems to be more silver circulating in southern Britain in the early 8th century than at any time until the later Middle Ages. This transforms our perception of trade, of economic activity, of markets. And the reason that we're getting that picture is that individual finds are now being recorded centrally, and we can get an overall picture of what they are. And they are monumentally large. So the book set out to examine the effect of these new technologies on archaeology. There's another chapter in the book which looks at magnetometry, of being able to see through the soil and look at discontinuities underground by magnetometers. But as I got started, the things were happening in my own life. My father died just as the book was starting. And we went through his house, and as you do. And my mother had died several years before. And so there were all the things that bring you up short. The box of letters that they'd written to each other during the war. The photographs from their respective families. My grandfather's discharge certificate from the army in 1918 at the end of the Great War. Little things like that. And I couldn't really find a way to start this book. Just to start a book about archaeology is always hard, and there's a lot of... It's like sort of trying to start a motor car, you know, when the starter motor keeps turning over but you can't get it going. And so I thought, well, I'll start with this. Here are four individuals, you know, my grandparents. I'll start with them. And the book began, therefore, when I finally got going, as an interaction between the individual and the personal experience and the big flow. Archaeology is the story of a great meta-narrative for part of the world over thousands of years, and real individuals who you can locate within that flow. And that led me to think about other real individuals going backwards in history, the medieval peasant. We don't know their name, but you know, you can see where they lived and what they did. Or our very first ancestors at the time when Britain perhaps just had just a few hundred hominins in it. We're talking now tens, hundreds of thousands of years ago. And I thought, well, nobody's ever really done a book that sort of began with the beginning of people in this country and came up to the present, which is where, of course, my grandparents were. So it evolved like that. So it wasn't a book I set out or planned. It's a book that took shape as a result of things that were going on around me.
Mm. You do lots of things in this book. You sort of run through the history of archaeology to start with in an interesting fashion, introducing us to lots of the big names in the story of archaeology. You give us these sort of personal anecdotes from your own life and from your archaeological career and from your recent family story. But you're also telling us the story of archaeology in England going back, as you said, millennia. But what you also do is to ask us whether we are looking at it in the right way. Basically, you're saying that we are guilty of over-categorising, and by looking at history through the way that we compartmentalise, by saying, you know, things happened in the Iron Age or the Bronze Age, that we miss something big. So perhaps you could just elucidate on what you're trying to say there.
Well, categorisation and periodisation are necessary things in order to give order to all the material we look at. I mean, the archaeological record is absolutely enormous. It is millions upon millions of items of data. So you've got to have some shape to that. But if you think about it like graph paper or the coordinates we put on maps or latitude and longitude, these are things that are of our own devising, which we use at the scale we want to make measurements or draw graphs or plot maps. But they are essentially abstract, they're artificial, they don't exist in real terms, they're only insofar as we make them. And historical periods are rather like that, and as I've said somewhere else, most historical periods are defined in contrast to another one. There are the Saxons and the Normans, or the Romans and the Britons. Now, those are our constructs. We've decided who these groupings are and what they represent. And if we stand back from those and look at the continuities, they may be just as important. And as you say, at the end of the book, potential continuities are found across periods that we have normally considered to be quite separate. There's a very good case that is mentioned in the book and is well published already, from the Witham Valley in Lincolnshire, where archaeological study over the last 20 years has discovered that the places where medieval religious houses were put in the 7th, 8th, 11th, 12th century coincide with places where votive metalwork was being put into the River Witham from the Bronze Age. Now, what's going on there? Are they trying to cancel those places? Are they trying to kind of stand guard over them and cancel out these earlier practices? No, because when you look at the metalwork deposits, we find that they're still putting votive metalwork into the rivers up until the 15th century. It's really only the sort of Reformation that sort of brings this to an apparent end. And one might look at this in another way, and this is not my idea, suggestion by Paul Everson and David Stocker, that in fact the religious houses are assuming the role of sort of guardians, if you like, of a sense of place, of a perceived sub-regional identity, and they are sort of taking on the responsibility, if you like, of maintaining that guardianship. The next guardians who seem to be doing this are, the book suggests, are actually poets. They take on the responsibilities for celebrating place and giving us a sense of place. I'm not arguing against the idea of periodization. I'm simply saying that if that's all we do, we miss things, and that some of the things may be very big and perhaps even bigger than the periods themselves.
That takes us into the Reformation, I guess, because that's one of the main points of... Is that a break? You know, it seems to be a big break for you, and, well, it's a big break for lots of people, but... Yeah. Before that, are you saying that there was a sort of a more of a harmony in terms of religion and society, and Christianity was more open to influences from outside? You talk a lot about pagan influences coming through, though you have just said that you don't see that as much, but, you know, that there were things that were going on that had pagan antecedents. But then after the Reformation, kind of all stops, doesn't it? Or at least, you know, the Puritans and the Civil War exacerbate that process. Mm. But is the Reformation the kind of the big moment when we start to move away from understanding the past in the fashion that perhaps you think we ought to?
Yeah, I used to think it was, and to some extent, I still think that it is a huge wrench. All kinds of things that are of great. Of long-standing significance are checked or brought to a halt by the Reformation. There is discussion in the book about the struggle that goes on for about another 100 years of expressing those things in new ways or doggedly defending them. And perhaps it is the Civil War that is the line that's drawn. But by the time the book was, I was really on the last pages for the last time. I was beginning to think that it was probably the later 19th century intensified industrialization, coupled with international migration, coupled with rapidity of communication that really, really did for it. I mean, I give the example of customs that were going on in my grandmother's house in Fulham, where at every full moon they would cover, the women in the house would cover the things made of glass with cloth so that the moon wouldn't shine through it. Well, you know, there's an ancient custom if ever there was one. And it's still going on in Fulham in the 1880s. I don't think it'll be going on there now. And so something, really big changes have happened in the last 100 years, I think, which have brought this to an end. So to answer your question, while the Reformation is hugely significant and has big consequences, the final line is being drawn probably in the last 150 years. And in some respects, therefore, the outlooks and sense of neighbourhood, actually, it's probably more in common with sort of Bronze Age England and the 18th century than there is between the 18th century and now.
Just sort of in conclusion, where does this approach take us in our understanding of archaeology? How have you moved us on in terms of our debate about archaeology and our understanding of England today?
I think... one of the things is that we need to take history seriously. There is an idea, and this is tackled quite early on in the book, that the further away something is, the less important it becomes historically. And by that token, you get what we have with the national history curriculum, which is that it starts around about, you know, AD 0 and the Romans, and it gets more detailed as time goes by. It's quite interesting that while we can't, obviously you can't teach prehistory as a national curriculum subject because there's so much else to do in the world of Michael Gove that you can't take it all in. Nevertheless, even awareness of it is not really brought into our educational system, and we tend to treat history lightly. So that when I was at the Council of British Archaeology, we get letters about dinosaurs and the Flintstones and things like this. And people's ideas about our history are very hazy beyond a certain point. And I think we need to take it seriously. We're never going to find out everything we want to know about it because the sources are imperfect, but we need to use them to their full stretch. And we need to understand ourselves as a species, which is something else that this book is about, better. And we do that by studying ourselves and where we've come from.
That was Richard Morris. Time's Anvil, England, Archaeology and the Imagination is published now by Weidenfeld & Nicholson. You can read a review of the book in our February issue, which has recently been published in both print and digital. Also in the edition, we've got articles on the 20 most important battles in British history, Hitler's philosopher allies, medieval royal finances, and Britain's relationship with Islam, as well as much more. And that's about all for this week's episode. Why not tell us what you thought by getting in touch on email, podcast@historyextra.com, Twitter @HistoryExtra, or Facebook/HistoryExtra. Next time we'll be talking about Georgian bankers and a reconstructed Bronze Age boat. Do join us for that. The History Extra weekly podcast is recorded in Bristol and produced by Jack Fletcher.